from feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world. This is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. On today's program, detained in Thailand, the military now holds former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra and other political leaders on day two of the country's coup.
This is so frustrating for the United States. It will set the U.S.-Thailand relationship back, and that's unfortunate.
Also today, the undignified row between Russia's president and the heir to the British throne, a warning by civil libertarians about police using tasers on children, and returning to ground zero, the doctor who first diagnosed Ebola.
We should think of our health as the health related to the health of animals. We call it One Health.
That's all ahead on FSN Reports, but first our summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Following the coup, Thailand's military leaders have detained former Thai Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra, along with other leading figures. Army Chief General Prayuth Chan-o-cha says there must be changes in the country before a new vote can be considered. He says the military takeover will give Thailand a chance to return to normal. But members of the international community, including France, Germany, and the United States, have been swift to condemn the coup. Tim Newton reports from Thailand.
As the first night of the military coup wore on, so too did the litany of announcements. First, it was a nationwide curfew between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. Then a command that all schools would be closed until Sunday. Then all radio and TV stations were told to cease normal transmission. Army General Prayuth Chan-o-cha has made several appearances urging calm by asking public servants to go to work as normal. He also insists that the coup was necessary to restore calm and pave the way to new elections.
As Ukraine prepares for presidential elections, Russian President Vladimir Putin says Russia will respect the vote, despite calling recent developments in Ukraine a full-scale civil war. The Russian president made his remarks at the ongoing economic forum in St. Petersburg. From Moscow, Daria Bandarchuk reports.
During the question and answer session at the forum, Vladimir Putin called the February events in Ukraine, when the pro-European protesters took power in Kyiv, a coup d'etat. He said the coup, backed by Russia's American and European partners, led to chaos and a full-scale civil war. The Russian leader, though, said Moscow will treat the choice of Ukrainians, who are set to vote in presidential elections on Sunday, May 25, with respect. But he added, in Moscow's view, it would have been better to hold a referendum and adopt a new constitution.
In China, billionaire tycoon Liu Han and his brother have been sentenced to death. Although he was publicly often a face of philanthropy, Chinese authorities say Liu Han led a mafia-style group that murdered 9 people and raised over $6 billion in assets. The court called the brothers deeply evil. In Washington, President Barack Obama is set to nominate rising star of the Democratic Party Julian Castro to serve as U.S. Housing Secretary. Mr. Castro is currently serving his third term as mayor of the city of San Antonio, Texas. The move is just one in a number of cabinet switches within the Obama administration. The shuffle began after Kathleen Sebelius stepped down from her position as Health and Human Services Secretary, following the highly criticized rollout of the Affordable Care Act. If confirmed, Mr. Castro will be the highest-ranking Hispanic American in the administration. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A U.S. judge has lifted a temporary order which prevented the U.S. military from force-feeding a prisoner at Guantanamo Bay who was on hunger strike. Jihad Diab is challenging the procedure, which the judge described as painful, humiliating, and degrading. Our Washington correspondent Daniel Wrenches reports.
Federal District Judge Gladys Kessler described her task in deciding whether to allow the force feeding of the inmate as an anguishing Hobson's choice. The military procedure of forcing a tube down the nose of the restrained inmate caused agony, according to her ruling. As for the alternative, she wrote, the court simply cannot let Mr. Diab die. Jihad Diab is a Syrian who's been held without charges at Guantanamo Bay for over 11 years. He was recommended for transfer about 4 years ago, but officials are reluctant to repatriate him to war-torn Syria and have refused an offer by Uruguay to take him in.
And the U.S. state of Tennessee is bringing back the electric chair, the first state to make it mandatory when lethal injection drugs are unavailable. The move follows a number of botched executions as the supply of death penalty drugs dries up because of a European ban on exporting execution drugs to the U.S. Nina Maria Potts has more.
The controversy over lethal injections has intensified over the past few months as European drug companies started banning U.S. prisons from using their drugs in executions. In April, a botched lethal injection in Oklahoma put the issue in the international spotlight. It was the state's first time using an experimental three-drug cocktail. Witnesses said convicted murderer Clayton Lockett convulsed and writhed and took 43 minutes to die. Tennessee's decision to now bring back the electric chair has death penalty activists up in arms.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to FSN Reports. The Thai military arresting five protesters in Bangkok after they defied a curfew and a ban on demonstrations imposed as part of the coup that began in the country yesterday. Today, former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra, members of her family and a host of other political leaders were detained, with some observers saying this coup, the country's 12th, has more threatening undertones than some of its predecessors. Six of Thailand's most senior military officers have been appointed to run the country, and the army has offered no guarantees about a return to civilian rule. The military takeover is severely complicating relations between Washington and Bangkok. The United States formally designated Thursday's events a coup and is urging the restoration of civilian rule. Ernie Bowers at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington says the events in Thailand are putting the Obama administration in a very tricky position.
It's a hard one for the United States. You can't win. If you call it a coup, you're going to alienate some ties and powerful ties, including obviously the military. If you don't call it a coup, you've sort of gone back on your own foreign policy principles, and you would have alienated part of the Thai population that obviously can win elections every time. So it would have to be, I guess, by definition, the majority of Thais. This is so frustrating for the United States. Thailand is a treaty ally, an important friend in ASEAN. And to have the coup take place and really force our hand to call it a coup and urge them to return immediately to democracy and elections really puts, it will set the U.S.-Thailand relationship back, and that's unfortunate.
Secretary Kerry has warned that the coup will have negative implications for U.S.-Thai relations, especially when it comes to military ties. Ernie Bowers of CSIS says that China could be one beneficiary.
Because of U.S. legislation, once we have determined that it's a coup, and the Secretary's statement makes clear that the U.S. View this as a coup, we will have to limit our military mil-to-mil engagement, including joint exercises, certain training, and military sales. And quite frankly, this is another hard spot for the United States because it opens the door to countries whose diplomatic engagement or foreign policy does not have, you know, ideology behind it, is not as principled and value-based. For instance, China. China has trained more Thai officers than the United States has over the last 2 years. And so if in a very Machiavellian way, China may want to take this opportunity to try to strengthen their relationship with the Thai military.
But Bowers argues that the Obama administration was right to come out early, calling this a coup. He says it's the best long-term play.
If you look across the Asia-Pacific, what's happening is an empowered middle class that's technically connected to the internet. These people are moving towards wanting a bigger role in governance. And I think, you know, U.S. foreign policy is on the right side here in the longer term. In the short term, this pinches. It hurts the U.S.-Thai relationship at least with the military or with certain ties. And I think that's difficult for us. So I think what is needed is a larger strategy, a more articulated strategy by the U.S. on why Asia is important, why we should be engaged there. And then I think if we have that lodestar of a long-term strategy, we could have a more nuanced set of messages and a very humble delivery of our foreign policy objectives that I think would go down well with ties and with the region.
That was Ernie Bowers, a senior advisor and Sumitro Chair for Southeast Asia Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. The Russian President Vladimir Putin said today that he will respect the outcome of this weekend's presidential elections in Ukraine. If the polls are correct, Petro Poroshenko, an industrialist whose confectionery empire has led him to be dubbed Ukraine's chocolate king, will become the country's next president. He's worked hard in the last few weeks to present himself as a candidate acceptable to both Western governments and the Russians. And at an economic forum in St. Petersburg today, President Putin was asked by CNBC correspondent Jeff Cutmore how he views the weekend ahead.
Just to put this on the record for our audience here, do you accept the legitimacy of the election that is going to take place on Sunday in Ukraine?
We all understand and we all see that people in Ukraine want to see their country emerge from this protracted crisis. And we will have respect for the choice that the Ukrainian people will make. We will watch very closely what will happen.
The Russian leader used his platform in St. Petersburg to encourage international businesses to invest in Russia and partner with the country. Meanwhile, in London, it's been a busy 24 hours for Russian diplomats based in the British capital. They lodged a protest with the British government after Prince Charles, heir to the British throne, reportedly compared Vladimir Putin to Adolf Hitler in a private conversation with a woman in Canada. It's created a potentially awkward moment next month. The two men are due to meet at a D-Day anniversary event in France. FSN's London Bureau Chief Ollie Barrett joins me now. So, Ollie, what exactly did Prince Charles say?
Well, he was on a royal tour of Canada. He's back now, but the prince met a former Polish war refugee at an immigration museum in Nova Scotia. She says that they were discussing together Hitler's takeover of countries in Europe when Prince Charles said to her that Nazi Germany's actions are not unlike what Putin is doing now.
And Russia, it seems, didn't like that very much.
No, they didn't. The Russian embassy here in London called the remarks outrageous. Russia's foreign ministry said the comments did him no credit. And state-backed media in Russia has also been fiercely critical of Prince Charles's comparison. One Kremlin-funded outlet has been saying that the British royals should be aware themselves of their historical links to Nazis before making such comments.
So what about any formal diplomatic response?
Well, Russia's deputy ambassador here in London did call for a meeting at the Foreign Office for clarification of what Prince Charles said, but it didn't really go as planned. Foreign Office mandarins told him in the meeting that they couldn't comment on a reported private conversation. And then they went on to use the opportunity with the deputy ambassador to urge him to urge Russia to step back from actions in Ukraine, which might destabilise that country. Clarence House here in London, which handles the prince's affairs, is also not commenting further, but it has said that the prince would not seek to make a public political statement during a private conversation.
And Ollie, in Britain, where people are used to Prince Charles occasionally speaking out, how have his comments gone down?
Reasonably positive response, actually. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, said also that he wouldn't comment on a private conversation, but that everyone is entitled to their private opinions. he says. His deputy, Nick Clegg, says that the prince should be free to express himself. And Labour leader Ed Miliband probably went the furthest, saying that, in his opinion, the prince has got a point. There are critics too, though, here in the UK. The campaign group Republic say that the prince is developing a track record for interfering in policy. And one Labour MP, a former Foreign Affairs Select Committee chairman, has said that the prince should end his, what he calls, freelance foreign policy. But Prince Charles has always been a royal with opinions. But as he takes on more duties from his mother, the Queen, he is being very closely watched for signs that he will start keeping those opinions to himself a little bit more.
FSN's London Bureau Chief, Ollie Barrett. Staying in Europe now, one of the world's biggest immunisation organisations is worried about a growing funding gap that could put lives at risk. The Gavi Alliance told a conference in Brussels that $7.5 billion is needed to guarantee the immunisation of millions of children over the next 5 years. But with the 2015 UN Millennium Development Goals fast approaching, pressure is mounting on governments to slash poverty levels, and that runs the risk of leaving vaccination programmes underfunded. From FSN's Brussels Bureau, Sandra Gutman reports.
It's just a simple jab, but vaccines save millions of lives each year. Vaccination drives are crucial in countries that lack adequate health facilities. For over a decade, the Gavi Alliance has led those initiatives. It aims to get private companies to work with governments to reduce child mortality rates, especially in Africa. Diseases like yellow fever, pneumonia, and influenza can be deadly without vaccines. Gavi claims more than 5 million lives have been saved so far, but during a replenishment conference in Brussels, it announced a huge funding gap of $7.5 billion. Gavi says international donors need to step up. The European Union has already responded, doubling its annual aid to the cause, a surprising move during a time of budget trimming. EU Commissioner for Development Andris Spielbergs.
As the time goes, we see even more need, really, to support Gavi. So we have decided to double our contribution to Gavi. That will be 25 million euros a year, just to really to get over the cliff, to get each child immunized, and actually achieve that 50% of children by 2050 will be fully immunized.
Governments also have a role to play, putting pressure on the private pharma industry to provide cheaper vaccines. Gavi's ultimate goal is sustainable immunization programs all over Africa. Yvonne Chaka Chaka is founder of the Princess of Africa Foundation.
I think it's important that countries, you know, invest in their own people to start with, so that when money from donors comes, it's like cherry on top. You know, it just helps them. I know most of the African countries, or not only African countries, there are countries that, you know, have problems. You know, finance becomes a huge problem. But I must really thank Gavi for doing what they are doing. But they insist that governments pledge their 15% on health that they promised in 2010.
The Gavi Alliance has one of the biggest immunization efforts in the world, spreading awareness of the fact that not only does getting vaccines to the world's poorest save lives, but it's a smart investment towards their future, especially when it comes to improving health systems. Erin Hochfelder is the One Campaign's Director of Global Health Policy.
In many cases, mothers bringing babies in to get vaccines is really the first touch point they have with the health system. It makes them feel comfortable, build trust in the health systems in their communities that then can be relied upon later in life to deliver other health interventions.
Gavi is confident it can plug its funding gap, but says it needs to happen soon. 1.5 million children still need immunization every year, and those stats will most likely continue to grow. Sandra Gatman, Brussels.
Civil libertarians in Britain are warning of the risks of using tasers against children after new figures showed that police in England deployed the electric stun guns 145 times over the past year against people who were under the age of 16. The statistics were revealed under a Freedom of Information request by Britain's LBC Radio. Oliver Sprague is the programme director for military security and police with Amnesty International.
Government scientific advice last issued in 2012 points to four additional risk factors when using it on children. One is risk to adverse effects on the heart because of the thinner bone structure. The other is risk to fall because of brittle bones. It argues that the psychological and traumatic effects of Taser in children are completely unknown. So in those circumstances, I think using a Taser against children is particularly risky and must be really, really the last resort. The Taser is a weapon that in some circumstances can be used. Remember, it was introduced into policing precisely for those types of incidents, genuinely life-threatening incidents that cannot be controlled by any other means. And in those circumstances, for example, someone armed with a knife, using a Taser may be an appropriate response. But let's think about that incident with young people. Let's think about the high levels of emotional distress and trauma that are likely to be associated with, for example, a self-harming incident. Now, is Taser necessarily the appropriate response in all of those situations? Is impaling a young child with two metal spikes and zapping incredibly painful, 5 seconds of incredibly painful electricity through them, necessarily the right response in those situations? So really, 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 if you're going to use it, it does have to be a weapon of last resort. It is true that the government guidance that I pointed to, the health and medical implications that were last issued in 2012, recommended that police look in their training with much greater scrutiny on the use against Taser. Now, in the Met situation, I know, for example, I sit on an independent review panel that meets every few months to look at Taser issues within the Met with Met Police. And I know that right now there is heightened concern within the Met against use against children, and those incidents are scrutinised with much greater scrutiny. So it's certainly the case that now it is being looked at very seriously in the Met.
Oliver Sprague of Amnesty International talking of the dangers of using Tasers against children. Finally today, FSN Spotlight, where we take a look at a story that you otherwise might have missed. And this evening, a return to ground zero for the microbiologist who first identified one of the world's most deadly viruses. Peter Piot was just 27 years old when he diagnosed Ebola for the first time in the mid-1970s. He went on to become the executive director of UNAIDS, the director of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and an Under-Secretary General of the United Nations. In this report, produced for the Financial Times, he talks to the FT's science editor, Clive Cookson, about his experiences.
In 1976, the young Belgian medical worker, Peter Piot, travelled to Yambuku, a remote Congolese village suffering from a devastating outbreak of a mysterious new illness. His work there helped to contain and identify the deadly Ebola hemorrhagic fever, which kills 90% of its victims. The death toll in Yambuku in 1976 was about 300. Peter went on to become one of the outstanding public health leaders of his generation, directing the global fight against HIV/AIDS for 13 years as head of UNAIDS. Earlier this year, Peter returned to the once flourishing village. I caught up with him in his director's office at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and I started by asking how Yambuku has changed since his original visit almost 40 years ago.
Today, I must say, there is kind of generalized decay. It was very sad to see. It's a very idyllic place, you know, it's beautiful. It's like a postcard nearly. But the buildings are kind of imploding, literally collapsing, some of them. There are no longer coffee plantations. There's no electricity, no running water, no shower, no fridge. But the hospital has a dedicated physician who I find is a hero, because to work in these circumstances is fantastic. It requires a lot of courage and dedication.
Now, you're best known as a public health leader for your work on another disease that originated in animals, which is HIV/AIDS. And I was interested that you found signs that back in 76 there was HIV infection, although, of course, no one had heard of the disease then.
Yeah, it's very interesting that AIDS was described for the first time in 1981 in the United States. But then we were seeing quite some patients coming from Central Africa when I was still working in Belgium. We went there. We found a major heterosexual epidemic. The dogma was that this is a gay disease, which of course is absurd, you know, from the perspective of a virus, doesn't work. But then I was always very intrigued, how long has this virus been around? Where is it coming from? And one of the first clues that it had been circulating in Central Africa was because we had preserved our blood samples from 1976 during the first Ebola outbreak. We had tested thousands of people in that region. And when the antibody test became available for HIV in 85, we tested these sera, and what did we find? There was already HIV in Yambuku area 5 years before the disease was described. That was very new, but it was at very low level. And 10 years later, we went back in 86, and it was at the same level. So what we found is that in an area where there isn't amplification of HIV through multiple sex partners and so on, it can remain at very low levels.
So what is there anything we can learn from these two very different diseases, Ebola and HIV/AIDS, that have moved from animals to people, about how we might treat anything that jumps out of the animal kingdom and bites us in the future?
New viruses will continue to emerge. We're seeing it actually in the most visible way with the regular appearance of new types of influenza viruses, yes, usually coming from China. And that's also originating in animals. It's ducks or chickens and sometimes, pigs. You know, so that's the first thing. It will continue. Secondly, we should think of our health as the health related to the health of animals, of other animals, I should say. We call it one health. Many new infections come from animals, and we'll see more and more of that. And a third, example of that is antimicrobial resistance. We are under threat of bacteria that may no longer be treatable. We already have it for tuberculosis, some forms, but also for kind of very common infections that you can acquire in a hospital.
Yes, the World Health Organization issued a warning just this week, a rather dire warning about the need to fight antibiotic resistance.
I agree, and I think that's one of the biggest threats to health for the future, because just imagine a world where bacterial infections, pneumonia or wound infections and what have you, are no longer treatable with the current antibiotics. Surgery, for many indications, heavy surgery would not be possible. Transplants, bone marrow transplants, some cancer treatments. So they all depend on the fact that we can control infection.
So finally, Peter, to sum it all up, how would you describe the state of global public health today?
Well, I'm an optimist by nature, otherwise I wouldn't have done in my life what I've done. But I think, first of all, there's no doubt that we're leading a longer life and better lives all over. But the bad news, I would say, is that there are new epidemics looming. Diabetes, cardiovascular disease is now becoming the top cause of death also in developing countries. It's no longer a problem of the affluent in developing countries or of our type of countries. Obesity is growing. When we talk about malnutrition today in a country like India, we have on the one hand 100 million children or so that are undernourished, and then we have soon the largest number of obese people in the same country. And so it's getting more complicated.
Peter Piot talking to Clive Cookson, science editor of the Financial Times. And you can see that interview and lots of other in-depth coverage on the FT's website, ft.com. And that's FSN Reports for this Friday. On Monday, a special edition of the programme looking at Russia in the era of Vladimir Putin. That's Monday. But for now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington. For everyone with FSN Reports everywhere, thanks for listening. Enjoy the long weekend. Goodbye.